From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Richard Russo about writing, book clubs, teaching, blurbing, and winning the Pulitzer Prize. He received the award this year for his best-selling novel, Empire Falls. It recently came out in paperback and is back on the bestseller list. Russo is also the author of the novel Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a film starring Paul Newman. And he has a new collection of stories called The Whore's Child. Also, we remember painter Larry Rivers and listen back to a 1992 interview. He died of liver cancer last week at the age of 78. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The body of Palestinian guerrilla leader Abu Nidal was found in a Baghdad apartment today. Members of his organization, the Fatah Revolutionary Council, claimed he committed suicide. Nidal was said to have carried out terror attacks against Palestinians and Israelis over a span of 20 years. At one time, the U.S. State Department labeled Nidal the most dangerous terrorist in existence. Israel has completed its troop pullout from Bethlehem and is withdrawing soldiers from the Gaza Strip as part of a new security agreement with the Palestinians. In exchange, the Palestinian Authority has vowed to try to prevent further attacks on Israelis. If the Palestinians are able to block militants from carrying out attacks on Israeli citizens, Israel says it will withdraw more troops from other Palestinian areas. Militant groups, including Hamas, say the deal will not stop them from attacking Israel. More than 80 Russian soldiers have been killed in a helicopter crash in Chechnya. Chechen separatist rebels claim to have shot down the helicopter. NPR's Lawrence Sheets has more from Moscow.
Russia's military says an engine fire caused the giant Mi-26 transport helicopter to crash just outside Russia's main military base in Chechnya, near the regional capital Grozny. Chechen rebels claim to have used a Zenith anti-aircraft gun to shoot down the helicopter, which was packed with 130 troops. A military source confirmed that it was likely the helicopter was brought down by enemy fire. The helicopter crashed into a minefield just 300 yards from the base. Some of the soldiers who survived the initial impact blew up on mines as they tried to flee the burning wreck. This would be one of the deadliest single attacks the separatists have staged in 8 years of on-and-off war with Russian forces. President Vladimir Putin has repeatedly claimed that the military phase of the conflict in Chechnya is over. Putin has called for an investigation. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
A spokesperson for the Office of Homeland Security says videotapes that aired today reportedly showing al-Qaeda training operations, including chemical weapons experiments, underscore the need to wage the U.S.-led war on terror. Gordon Jandreau says the tapes aired on CNN are further evidence of what the Bush administration knew, that al-Qaeda leaders would use chemical weapons if they had them. Bank deposits in Argentina are up for the first time since its economic crisis last December. Patricia Nazario reports from Buenos Aires.
According to the report by the Bank of the Province of Buenos Aires, Argentines deposited nearly $60 million more than they withdrew over the last month. The report says about a third of the money was deposited in peso accounts, while the rest went into dollar-denominated accounts. After a four-year recession, Argentines began panicking last year and withdrew about $26 billion before banks were shut down in April. Some economic experts in the country are calling this shift a vote of confidence in Argentina's ability to recover from the worst economic depression in its history.
Reporter Patricia Nazario. This is NPR. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained more than 210 points to close just below 9,000. The Nasdaq closed up nearly 34 points. The S&P 500 added 22. Another sign that the economy faltered somewhat last month, the nonprofit business research group The Conference Board reported today its closely watched index of leading economic indicators fell 0.4% last month. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The LEI, an indicator designed to predict the direction of the economy 3 to 6 months down the road, fell again last month after dropping by a revised 0.2% in June. The decline in the index was double that for July. However, the Conference Board also points to the fact that in historical terms, the decline in the index has been relatively mild. From its peak in December of 2000 to its low point, the LEI has fallen only around 1.7%. And the so-called coincident index, which measures current economic activity, last month was actually up 0.1%. Still, the fact 6 of 10 indicators that make up the leading index were lower last month shows the economy is faltering. It was the worst one-month decline for the index since September of last year. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The White House confirmed today President Bush will not be attending the World Earth Summit in Johannesburg next week. Secretary of State Colin Powell will lead the U.S. delegation. The president's decision not to attend the conference was criticized by environmentalists and Democrats, who say the decision could backfire as Mr. Bush looks for international support to oust Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Conservatives who oppose new international environmental treaties have advised the president to stay away from the upcoming summit. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Noyce Foundation, dedicated to improving math and science instruction from kindergarten through grades 12.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back from vacation. My thanks to Barbara Bogave for hosting the show while I was gone. My guest, Richard Russo, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his best-selling novel, Empire Falls. It recently came out in paperback and is back on the bestseller list. Russo also has a new collection of short stories called The Whore's Child. Most of Russo's fiction is set in upstate New York, in small working-class towns where there hasn't been much work since the factories closed down. Those fictional towns are inspired by Gloversville, New York, where Russo grew up. His novels include Mohawk, The Risk Pool, and Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a film starring Paul Newman. Russo's satirical novel, Straight Man, was inspired by his experiences teaching at 5 colleges. The final one was Colby College in Maine, where Russo still lives. The title story in his new collection, The Whore's Child, is also set in a college. It's told from the point of view of a professor who was surprised to find an elderly nun has gate-crashed his creative writing seminar. Her name is Sister Ursula. Here's a reading.
She appeared in class that first night and settled herself at the very center of the seminar, despite the fact that her name did not appear on my computer printout. Fiction writing classes are popular and invariably oversubscribed at most universities, and never more so than when the writer teaching it has recently published a book, as I had done the past spring. I'd gotten quite a lot of press on my recent book, my first in over a decade, and my fleeting celebrity might have explained Sister Ursula's presence in my classroom the first chilly evening of the fall semester, though she gave no indication of this, or that she recognized me as her neighbor. After class, I did explain why it would be highly unprofessional of me to allow her to remain in the advanced fiction workshop. After all, she freely admitted that she'd never attempted to write a story before, which, I explained, put her at an extreme disadvantage. My mistake was in not leaving the matter there. Instead, I went on. This is a storytelling class, sister. We're all liars here. The whole purpose of our enterprise is to become skilled in making things up, of substituting our own truth for the truth. In this class, we actually prefer a well-told lie, I concluded, certain that this would dissuade her. She patted my hand as you might the hand of a child. Never you mind, she assured me, adjusting her wimple for the journey home. My whole life has been a lie. I'm sure you don't mean that, I told her.
It's Richard Russo reading from his new collection of short stories, The Whore's Child. Why did you want to place a nun in a writing class to get this story started?
Well, actually, this story has a strange genesis. It was actually a part of my novel Straight Man, which was an academic satire and rather light, I think, in comparison to this story. And she was originally one of Hank Devereaux's students in that novel. And when I turned the novel into my editor, I said, what do you think about Sister Ursula here? I love her and I love her story, but it's kind of a dark one. And my editor agreed and said, you know, I love her too, but we got to get her out of this book because we're never going to be able to get back to the tone of that novel. But I think even as it stood in Straight Man, I think that somewhere, I don't think I probably had figured this out in any kind of, you know, analytical way, but I think I had in the back of my mind that we were going to get to the heart of Sister Ursula's story through fiction, that that was the only way she was ever going to be able to get at the heart of her story, was by trying to write the truth about it and then having in some way the truth come out through some sort of back door, through the very act of storytelling.
One of the interesting things about this story is that the nun who comes to the writing class has a truly terrible story to tell. She's been a nun her whole adult life, but she is the daughter of a prostitute. She never really knew her father, and there's a lot of mystery tied up in her feelings about her father and in who her father really was. She feels in some ways her whole life has been a lie, and she's trying to get this all down, but she's actually a terrible storyteller as a writer. You write in the story, her story seemed to be moving forward without exactly getting anywhere. It reminded the students of stories they'd heard other elderly people tell, tales that even the tellers eventually managed to forget the point of, narratives that would eventually peter out with the weak insistence that all these events really did happen. So I'm wondering what it's like as a teacher, as a former teacher now, to deal with students who have these really urgent stories to tell and can't quite express it in writing.
Yeah, I mean it can be excruciating for both them and the teacher. It can also be very funny. There's a lot of, despite the fact that Sister Ursula's story that she has to tell is a brutal and cruel one. The story as related in The Horse Child is also very funny because of the ways in which the students try to come to terms with the story that she is telling them. And it's much like that between teacher and student, because the student has very often a series of true things, a series of true events. So the first thing that the teacher has to do is honor the material by suggesting that, yes, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the material, and yes, a story can be made out of this. But you're going to have to turn this into something artful, which means that at some point or other in the story, what actually happened is going to fail you, because all that will ever be is a sequence of events. But it won't be a sequence of events that is, as in the section that you read, that's actually going anywhere. It's proceeding without getting anywhere. And the teacher is really at this kind of the ground zero of storytelling and understanding and getting students to understand that what happened will not be sufficient to the story.
Did you ever feel that you inadvertently seriously wounded a student through your critique of their writing?
Oh, I'm sure of it. I can't think so much of a particular instance. I remember one case. I suppose at Colby College, it was a very, very smart young woman who had turned in a story that just wasn't very good. And it wasn't very good in a way that was approachable. I mean, you could explain to her at what level it was failing. But there was no way to do it with as much. Well, you just kind of had to say it. Here's what's wrong, and I know that she was terribly wounded by that. She was on the verge of tears leaving the class, and as often happens, those tears turn to rage the very next day in my office, and we went through the whole thing again. After she finished telling me what was wrong with me, but by the end of that office hour, we had managed to go back to the story and get it on track in a way that would work for her without compromising the thing that was most important to her in telling the story to begin with. So I mean, yeah, these, and I'm not really sure from a student's point of view whether the serious work that a real writer is going to do can be done without that kind of criticism, and sometimes even without that kind of pain that you have to come through.
Did you go through that kind of pain yourself from critiques?
Oh, you bet.
When you were a student, yeah.
Yeah, I know that. I know that from firsthand experience. I was not. I was not a quick study as a writing student. I had been reading literature seriously as a PhD student through what is the opposite end of the telescope. And when it came time for me to write, I had a lot of bad habits, a lot of bad expository habits. I wanted to both write the story and write the cliff notes of the story at the same time.
Don't tell what it all meant.
Yeah.
It's symbolized.
Yeah. it was pretty ugly. and you know, I had to be told that not just once but repeatedly. And yeah, it was very wounding, but absolutely necessary. And so yeah, I, as I say, I was not a quick study at all, and so I recognize the problems, many of them, when I see them in students, because most of the mistakes that are out there to be made, I made as an apprentice myself.
Well, you did good. You won the Pulitzer Prize this year for your novel Empire Falls, which I might add is now out in paperback. So what does the Pulitzer change, and what does it not change when it's time to sit down to write?
Well, it's a wonderful validation. Somebody asked me the other day if it was the greatest achievement of my career, and without wanting to in any way diminish what the prize has meant, because you know it is given this particular novel and also my backlist wings out there. So it's been absolutely wonderful. But it was certainly no more thrilling for me than my first story, which was published in a literary magazine with a circulation of about 300, and I was paid in, I think, 7 contributors' copies, which was a smaller number of copies than there were members of my family to send it to. So, but I remember being absolutely just insane with pride at somebody saying yes to a story of mine. The thrill was I can still feel it of that first story. And the first time somebody said yes and published a novel of mine, my first novel, Mohawk, was a similar kind of validation. And I think all of these kind of when wonderful things like this happen, what ultimately it does is that it suggests to the novelist that you know, you've done the right thing, you've made the right career choice. Go ahead, write another. What it doesn't change, of course, is that the pages when I sit down to write in the morning are still empty until I fill them up, and it doesn't make the process any easier. I'm just as prone to making mistakes as I ever was. But by and large, it's just a wonderful validation that gives you the kind of courage to start another book.
My guest is Richard Russo. His Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Empire Falls, is out in paperback, and he has a new collection of short stories called The Whore's Child. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Russo is my guest. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his best-selling novel, Empire Falls. Now he has a new collection of short stories, which is called The Whore's Child. Well, Empire Falls is about a man in his 40s who has returned to his hometown, and there he runs a restaurant. It's not the work that he really wanted to do. It's not really where he wants to be living, but it's because basically a family commitments and wanting to bring up his daughter there that keeps him there. Do you want to read the opening paragraph for us?
Sure. The Empire Grill was long and low slung with windows that ran its entire length. And since the building next door, a Rexall drugstore, had been condemned and razed, It was now possible to sit at the lunch counter and see straight down Empire Avenue all the way to the old textile mill and its adjacent shirt factory. Both had been abandoned now for the better part of two decades, though their dark, looming shapes at the foot of the avenue's gentle incline continued to draw the eye. Of course, nothing prevented the person from looking up Empire Avenue in the other direction, but Miles Roby, the proprietor of the restaurant and its eventual owner, he hoped, had long noted that his customers rarely did.
That's the opening paragraph of Richard Russo's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Empire Falls. Why did you want your main character to run a restaurant?
Well, he had to do something. I'm not sure. I wanted, you know, it could have been a restaurant. He could have been an insurance agent. He could have been doing anything, I suppose, that contrasted with the way that he had seen himself when he was young, which was perhaps as a college professor. He is a young man who went away from a small town to college and found out that it was really his world, and had looked forward to living the life of the mind. And so I wanted some sort of profession for him that would contrast with that. But as you know, probably from reading other novels of mine, I'm very fond of restaurants and diners, especially in small towns, because of my interest in community.
Why don't you describe the town you grew up in?
The town that I grew up in was Gloversville, and in upstate New York. And it was, as you would expect, a tannery town. My grandfather was a glove cutter. My father cut leather from time to time, did among myriad other jobs that he performed, and that I performed with him when I was growing up. But it was at the time when I was growing up, it was a one industry town that had already pretty much bottomed out in terms of that industry. It was like a lot of my towns, unlucky in that after World War II, women stopped wearing gloves at about the same time men stopped wearing hats. And when you're a town that doesn't do much besides glove cutting and a whole generation of women stop wearing gloves, you're in a little bit of trouble. And also, of course, the other thing that was happening, too, was that there were where gloves used to actually be cut in Gloversville. A lot of them now were being made overseas and in some cases actually shipped to Gloversville, all made except for maybe a button or something to be stitched on. And once that was done, they could claim that the glove was made in Gloversville. So there was, it was the tag end of an era for a town. And once that industry began to go south, there wasn't an awful lot to replace it. And what did come in to replace it certainly wasn't of the same sort of jobs that had left.
No, you left home. You went to college and you left home, so you didn't make your professional life in that kind of small town, at least not. You've taught in several places, probably some of those were small towns, but it wasn't the post-industrial small town that you grew up in.
Right.
But your characters always are there, or usually are there. Why have you kept your characters in that kind of town through the years?
Well, I'm not sure how many writers out there are giving voice to the kinds of people that I write about. When I was going to college and doing a lot of various kinds of construction work with my father, I think it was probably in between my junior and senior year. I was a laborer, but I was working with carpenters. And if you're a college kid and you're working with laborers, carpenters, people like that in the summer, they ridicule and berate in a very good-natured way because, you know, they know that you're going away. You're going back to a world of books and ideas, and they're going to continue doing this very hard work that they've been doing for a long time. I liked these men a lot. And one of them that summer, I remember saying to me I said, well, I'll see you next year or something. I'll see you soon. And he looked at me because, of course, that was a lie. And it was just a way of saying goodbye. And he looked at me and he said, no, I'm never going to see you again. You're never going to see me again. You're going to become educated and you're going to get a job somewhere teaching kids. And you're going to have a good, easy life. And you're going to forget about me and all the guys like me. And that'll be that. And he didn't say it in such a way that he thought that was a bad thing. He said it in a way that suggested that was what it was about. That was what he hoped would happen. And in a way, I mean, what he said was partly true, because I did, you know, I finished that degree and then did another after that and educated myself out of the kind of very hard back-breaking work that I used to do in the summers with my dad, but he was wrong about forgetting these people, and I find myself in my imagination, for reasons that I don't entirely understand myself, going back into this world and giving voice to the kinds of people who I still have an enormous amount of respect for and also understanding of. I suspect that I understand the people in places like Empire Falls probably better than any other world that I have inhabited since then. And I've inhabited, you know, the world of academe and some other worlds. But this is the one that I know kind of way below the skin.
Richard Russo's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Empire Falls is out in paperback. His new collection of short stories is called The Whore's Child. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools, 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember painter Larry Rivers and listen back to a 1992 interview. He died last week at the age of 78. And we continue our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Russo and talk about book clubs, book blurbs, and writing in restaurants.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Richard Russo. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction this year for his best-selling novel, Empire Falls. It recently came out in paperback, and it's back on the bestseller list. His previous novels include Mohawk, Straight Man, and Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a film starring Paul Newman. Russo has a new collection of short stories called The Whore's Child. Let's pick up where we left off. You know, you had said before that when you started writing, it was as if you were writing what you were writing and writing the cliff notes for it at the same time because you were doing so much explaining of the meaning and everything. Well, now your books are actually used a lot in book clubs. In fact, the USA Today book club chose Empire Falls as its first book club book. What have you learned about your readers and what people read into your books from the book clubs? And how people interpret or even misinterpret your books?
I have to say, Terry, I'm not sure I even understand these various book clubs. I was talking with a writer friend of mine the other day who was saying with a rather melancholic expression that these book clubs are keeping an awful lot of us writers afloat these days, and I think that's true, and many of us have a great deal to be grateful for in that respect. But it's a phenomenon that I have to say I don't entirely understand. Do these people miss their old high school English classes so much that they want to come back and recreate the experience of talking about novels? And I always think of reading as an intimate, one of the most intimate of experiences. I mean, it's like sex. I'm not sure it improves in groups. it gets weird out there. But on the other hand, I mean, it's wonderful that people are excited about books, all kinds of books. And it's certainly nothing wrong with a group of people getting together with a glass of wine, although I think the wine is essential to a lot of these gatherings. And talking about books and being excited about them. I'm excited about books too, although I have to admit it's probably I'm jaded because I spent so many years in the classroom talking about books in the same way that book club members are now talking about them. And so probably as somebody who did that professionally, I don't feel any great urgency. I feel urgency about books. When I read one I love, I thrust it into the hands of my friends and say, you have to read this. But I'm excited about the book, but I'm not. I don't have that feeling that after they've read it, that we then have to sit down and talk about it. I feel like I've discharged my duty in giving it to them, and they've discharged their duty in reading it.
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I understand that there actually are the equivalent of cliff notes being published now for reading groups.
Oh, of course, yes. That coincides, I think, with the paperback publication of a lot of, quote, serious fiction these days gets published in editions that will have, kind of readers group questions attached to them specifically for this purpose.
Have you seen any of those things for any of your books?
Yeah.
What's that experience like?
I don't know because I didn't read them, but I know that they're there.
Why won't you read it?
Well, as I say, I don't read for credit anymore. I'm 53 years old now. I also don't read interviews. I read reviews of my novels because you'll often learn things in those. But I can't read interviews that I've given because it's like staring at yourself too long in the mirror. And I feel the same way about these the reader's guides that come out for my own novels. I don't think I'd have any objection to reading. I might enjoy actually reading the reader's guide questions for somebody else's books, but to look at them for your own is again, it's just a little bit like staring lovingly in the mirror. I don't think I'd care to do that.
Now, the main character in Empire Falls runs a restaurant. You are reported to do a lot of writing in restaurants and cafes.
What do you like about writing in a public space?
I don't know if I like it. It's actually that I like it. I've just been doing it so long now. It's just part of my modus operandi, I guess. I certainly didn't start doing it because I enjoyed it. I was teaching at the time and teaching, you know, lots of courses, and you know, I was probably going over to the school cafeteria to steal an hour and a half between classes, and you know, wolfing a hamburger, and then trying to steal an hour with all the cafeteria type nonsense going on around me, because it was the only time I had to write. And I think that, you know, at the time I used to think, my God, won't it be wonderful if I ever get to the point where I can have a study, you know, I can actually have a place to work, it'll be quiet, and won't that be great? And of course I now have such a place and I can't work in it. It's too quiet. And it's just become part of my, ritual. I certainly wouldn't recommend it to anybody. It's just something that has always, worked for me. And I have to admit, the nicest thing about writing in a public place is that when you come out of your trance, because I can work in a place that's very busy and not know anything that's going around me for like a couple of hours at a time, when you come out of it and there are other people around, it's kind of nice, because you're just immediately back in the real world and there are people going about their lives, and it's different from coming out of the trance in the middle of in the middle of your own study, where it's quiet and you see that that 2 hours have elapsed and there's nobody around. Writing is kind of a lonely business and a lonely endeavor. And it's, if you can do it as I do in a public place and then kind of come out of it into the world, into the real world with real people, that's actually quite nice.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's almost easier for you to sit down to write in a public space. You know, a lot of writers have to go through a lot of self-deception and before sitting down to write. Like, oh, this isn't going to be that hard.
Yeah.
I'm only going to do it for a half hour. But if you're doing it like in a cafe or something, well, it's a nice social setting. People are going about their business.
Right. Yeah, the phone rings, it's not for you.
That's right.
That's the other thing, too, is that... Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of things going on, but none of it means anything to you. And if you're not going to write, I don't really have any reason to be there. So unlike at home, you know, you find yourself staring into the refrigerator. You don't even know how you got there. You know, you've been upstairs. You were going to work. Suddenly, there you are with the refrigerator door open, staring in there. Stephen Dobbins has a wonderful poem about a middle-aged man staring into the refrigerator as if that was the place where the answers were kept. if you're out somewhere where you don't have to worry about the television or the telephone or the refrigerator or check your email or any of those things. And there's great advantages to having all of those distractions, you know, a couple of blocks away.
One last question. What are you reading this summer?
You know, I don't read hardly any books anymore that are actually bound books. I've been reading manuscripts. I've been reading galleys, bound galleys. They come anymore at the clip of about 4 a week. Once a book is actually between covers, I stand a much less of a chance of reading it. By the time a book is published, I'm probably not going to be able to get to it.
Is this because everybody wants a blurb from you?
Yeah, sure. So I've had a good summer in terms of my reading. I liked Julia Glass's novel Three Junes a lot, and Gene Harfenis's book A Short History of the Flood is terrific. Those are two that I can recommend, and a couple of others that won't be out yet for another 6 to 9 months or so. So I won't recommend those right now because they're not available. But
you have no problem with blurbing on new books?
No problem. Yeah, I mean, actually, I benefited early in my career. Mm-hmm. John Irving, who doesn't give blurbs anymore, I understand, was. Said some kind things about Mohawk, and Pat Conroy said kind things about the Risk Pool, and those came at a time in my young writer's life when they were just enormously helpful to have a writer of that stature say something nice about my work. And so I've tried to whenever I can return the favor.
Right, be generous, but be honest.
As much as, yeah, I mean, I think everybody realizes that the blurb, that the blurb industry is what it is. I don't think that a lot of what happens in the blurb industry has nothing to do with even the public. I think it's people, it's individual editors in individual houses trying to get up enthusiasm for the publication of this book within their own house, getting the people in advertising and marketing as excited as the people are in editorial. So the blurbs are used for all sorts of different reasons, and it's just a part of the landscape.
Right. Well, Richard Russo, thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it, Terry, as always.
Oh, thanks. Richard Russo's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Empire Falls is out in paperback. His new collection of short stories is called The Whore's Child. Coming up, we remember painter Larry Rivers and listen back to a 1992 interview. He died last week. This is Fresh Air. Painter Larry Rivers died last week of liver cancer. He was 78. We waited until today for our remembrance so that we could devote more time to it. As Carrie Rickey put it, Rivers wedded representation with abstraction, parodied art history, anticipated by a decade the concerns of both the pop and color field painters, and prophetically engaged in what postmodernists might call appropriation and deconstruction. New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman wrote, "Rivers helped change the course of American art in the 50s and 60s, but his virtues as an artist always seemed inextricably bound up with his vices, the combination producing work that could be by turns exhilarating and appalling. He had an omnivorous curiosity about life, sex, drugs, politics, history, and culture." Larry Rivers' good friend, the late poet Frank O'Hara, summed up Rivers this way, "Larry entered the scene like a demented telephone. Nobody knew whether to put it in the library, the kitchen, or the toilet, but it was electric." I spoke with Larry Rivers in 1992.
Now, often when you paint a figure, there's a feature that's missing, you know, like there's one eye, but the other eye is kind of blank. It hasn't been painted at all.
Yes.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I think there was a certain spontaneity in my work. In other words, if no matter what I was doing, I wanted it to come off sort of quickly or without too much trouble. And, you know, as yet I hadn't arrived to the point where I wanted things to look labored and that I really did a lot of hard work, which would be a reflection of a certain kind of good character. So the first eye, you don't have to worry about where you're placing. I mean, you just put it down somewhere below a brow or something like that. But when you come to the second eye, you really have to make calculations about how wide they're apart. There's no way of putting in a second eye unless you're Picasso, to make them realistic without sort of real close judgment and changes and things that would slow you down, would make your hand work, let's say, from the knuckles instead of an arm movement. And I think that I just left it out at first. For those reasons, I didn't think it was necessary, really, what it amounted to. And I think there are other parts of the body missing, too, but people notice it in the face because the face is so clearly a you know, an image that we know all the parts of.
Something else you've done throughout most of your career is write on paintings. Sometimes the letters are stenciled, sometimes handwritten.
Yeah.
Sometimes parts of letters are missing or blurred. How did you start using words on paintings?
Well, I think that... don't forget the Cubists had the word journal. I mean, they would have a newspaper in their painting. So in other words, I didn't do anything that was that, you know, new. The only thing is, I think I was bolder about it and didn't hide it in a certain way. And it also, at certain paintings, it's almost the point of the painting. I did these vocabulary lessons, which obviously are words and features. And I thought that I thought there was something sort of ironic, I suppose, in all that. And please forgive me for trying to be ironic, but that was one of the reasons. Also, my hand is a very, you know, artistic one in the sense that I make gestures with my paint, and they're like loose, flowing, and things like that. Whereas a letter has sharp edges, and it's very much more definite than the painting. So the combination of this very definite thing, plus this loose, you know, arty kind of work with colors all over the place, seemed to make me happy.
You married when you were pretty young.
Yes.
Your girlfriend got pregnant, and that's right. How you ended up getting married. She already had a son.
Right.
But you didn't want a family. In fact, you wrote, "My life was not going to be about living. It was going to be about art."
Right.
So you felt pretty trapped by having a family.
I guess so. I given my personality, I probably didn't even feel trapped. I nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've felt a little bit something. Don't forget, I never really gave them up, and eventually I really brought them up. I brought up these boys and lived with the woman's mother. I lived with my wife's mother. I didn't live with the wife. So it's complicated looking it over. I mean, I was not going to be stopped from what I wanted to do, but at the same time wasn't going to abandon the boys or, you know, the mother. And we lived together, and they were very helpful in many ways.
Do you think that you couldn't have become an artist without being somewhat selfish?
That's right. I think I modeled myself on my distorted notion of what Picasso was about. I thought that somewhere along the line I had heard that, without reading it somewhere, that Picasso, you know, walked away from every relationship and children and things like that, and all that life was about was art. And I felt that that model was something that it was of interest to me.
Looking back, do you think that you behaved badly toward your family?
Some people might. I don't think I behaved badly. I made up in one way I was sort of, you know, on my own, selfish, things like that, but at the same time I provided for them. And so it's not very different than what most men are about. They go to offices 8-10 hours a day, and they come back and don't bother me. They're looking at television or a newspaper, they're drinking a beer or whatever it is, and then the child walks in, they give them a 2-minute kiss. Maybe once a year they go somewhere for 3 weeks or something. I don't think life is that different, you know, among for myself and other people.
We're listening back to a 1992 interview with the painter Larry Rivers. He died last week of liver cancer. He was 78. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. The painter Larry Rivers died last week at the age of 78. He had liver cancer. Let's get back to the interview we recorded in 1992. Now, your mother-in-law, who you lived with for many years, you painted her naked a couple of times.
Yes.
And I'll just describe her physically briefly. She's you know, an older woman, kind of heavy, and almost what we'd describe as peasant-like body.
Okay.
Is it fair?
I never heard that expression about a body. Go ahead. But anyway, you mean the painting that's in the Whitney Museum? It's Birdie Twice?
Birdie Twice, yeah. Why did you want, you know, it seems like a real taboo, don't you think, to paint your mother-in-law naked?
Well, I told my mother-in-law, if you read the book, that part, I said to Birdie, she sort of said, why do you want to paint me? You know, she had the simple notion that an artist wants to paint beautiful things. She looked at herself, she didn't think she was beautiful. So I said, Rembrandt painted older women, I forget her name anyway, she's got her 2 feet in a stream and she has a kind of a gown raised up, and she's not a young woman. Now, you didn't see her breast, but there are others that Rembrandt did where you do see this older woman. I thought that I had a very special opportunity. I was able to get someone that age, close to me, who actually I could really look at and see what was going on. So it had two levels. I painted it to make a painting and things like that, but I couldn't help be aware of what, you know, happens to the body. I was actually amazed that it looked that good. What I mean, I'm talking about on a sexual level. She didn't really seem to me to be unattractive.
Were you uncomfortable, or was she uncomfortable when she was posing for you?
I certainly wasn't uncomfortable. I felt that she maybe the first few times, then she sort of, it was okay. It was a son-in-law, you know, she thought that anything she could do to help. Mm-hmm. I told her, you know, that maybe we'll sell that painting, something. So she actually thought she was posing for the good reason, a working-class woman who thought that, you know, we would make some money or something like that. And
did you?
Did I? I think when I sold those paintings, they weren't very expensive and things like that. I made something, sure. But I wish I had a lot of them today. I would have made more.
Now, you also did a naked painting of your son, Joe.
Yep.
When he was 14. And right. There's a part in your book where he talks about what it was like,
yes,
to be painted by you. And he wrote that he wanted to be immortalized in your paintings, but he didn't really want to hang around and pose nude for it. He was 14 at the time.
Right.
In the painting, he's nude except for his socks. He says his pubic hair was just coming in.
Right.
And then the portrait was shown at the Southampton Gallery in Long Island, New York, and half of the high school from that area had their parental permission to go to the gallery.
Right.
And he was very embarrassed.
Now to walk into that gallery, they had to have a note from their parents that they could walk into that gallery. Go ahead.
And then finally the police removed the painting,
right,
of your son, and he was relieved. And he says to this day he has a twinge of embarrassment when he sees it.
Yeah.
Did you realize he was going to feel that way, that, you know, at the age of 14 it was going to be kind of embarrassing?
It was all very jolly, like I suppose a lot of families in which, you know, there's a central pot everybody's dipping into, and that's the sort of the ones that don't speak of the dark things. I think that he may have felt that way, but maybe I even thought about it, but I didn't think it was anything too much to ask of a child, truthfully speaking. And I think he actually, you know, he did. He knew he was a painter, and that's what I do, and that he would be useful. If he was embarrassed, I'm sorry. You know, so what?
So how did you feel when the police took the nude portrait of your son away?
I wasn't surprised, actually. I thought, you know, it's the United States of America, and that's what they do. And I thought it was following a certain pattern. I actually got a boot out of it. Like, in other words, when do you start hearing of people? Only when they do something sort of like Mapplethorpe. No one heard of Mapplethorpe until those things were shown, and everybody got into the act about how horrible and pornographic and, you know, base it was and things like that. So I probably thought I was following a certain, you know, path of the avant-garde. Like, you do a painting, there's a lot of clamor, take it down, and then it ends up in history books. When that was first painted, thousands of people protested. Now look, it's a masterpiece. I must have thought all that.
So you thought maybe it was a good career move?
Well, not exactly career move, but you mean that they took it down?
That they took it down, yeah.
Maybe. I didn't think exactly that way, but it got a lot of attention because of it.
You were very close with the poet Frank O'Hara. You were lovers for a while, even though you don't think of yourself as homosexual and have, you know, been married
twice. I was so straight I could be homosexual.
But you write that you started thinking of yourself for the first time as sexually attractive when you started hanging out in homosexual circles.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Well, how did it affect me? Well, I just said it. To feel sexually attractive is rather pleasant. But I think that I didn't get that. I'm not saying that that's why I got interested in men, but that there was that difference in my existence, that women didn't talk about, you know, some guy with a great ass or, you know, a great basket, as the homosexual talk at that time, and the area around the fly as it's telling you what's going on inside it. But it was sort of interesting. I mean, it brought me up to another level about sex, that I too could be, exciting to someone, is really what it amounted to. Now, I really wanted it to be with women. They would go to bed with you, but I never got the feeling that they went to bed with you because you were sexually exciting. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of silly. I feel now like a baby. I can't see how they could have not thought that. Why would they go to bed with me? They wanted to have sex with me. But I never interpreted it that way.
When you were younger, you were part of a circle of artists, musicians, poets, and I mean, there were even like artist bars to hang out in. Is there anything in your life like that now?
No. I have a band, but there's no place. You have personal friends. And I don't go to bars. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing because people know you, or
no, not because people know me. It's that you. I thought bars were a place to go to try to pick up someone, forgive me. And to the idea of sitting there with this notion in my mind, looking the way I do, and, getting the treatment of Mr. Rivers, where you're no longer a possibility for a liaison, but just respected citizen of Southampton or wherever you are, or they don't even know. It's just... it's too obvious, and I think that it just doesn't work anymore.
Okay.
So I stay home and paint.
Larry Rivers, recorded in 1992 after the publication of his memoir. He died last week at the age of 78. He had liver cancer. The Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. has extended its retrospective of Rivers' work until August 25th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Linley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the late 60s, Wayne Kramer's band, the MC5, released the album Kick Out the Jams. Their music was the soundtrack for many protests. The band is now considered one of the forerunners of punk rock. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kramer about the MC5 and his new CD, Adult World. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.